Radio Prague News. Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka has announced his plans to dismiss two members of his own party, Health Minister Svatopluk Němeček and Human Rights Minister Jiří Dienstbier, from the coalition government. British government will continue to protect EU citizens living on its territory even after Brexit, UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson told his Czech counterpart during their meeting in Prague. And President Miloš Zeman has apologized to the US ambassador to the Czech Republic, Andrew Shapiro. Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka has announced his plans to dismiss two members of his own party, Health Minister Svatopluk Němeček and Human Rights Minister Jiří Dienstbier, from the coalition government. Mr. Sobotka made the announcement on Friday after the meeting of the Social Democratic Party leadership. He has proposed Miloslav Ludvík, a long-time head of Prague's Motol Hospital, to replace Svatopluk Němeček in the post of health minister and recommended the Social Democratic deputy Jan Chvojka to become the new Minister of Human Rights. British government will continue to protect EU citizens living on its territory even after Brexit, UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson told his Czech counterpart Lubomír Zaorálek during their meeting in Prague on Friday. He also said London wants to ensure that there will be no business barriers between Britain and other EU member states once Brexit happens. Mr. Johnson has also met with Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka, who told him it was crucial for the Czech Republic to ensure respect for the rights of Czech citizens living in Britain, regardless of Britain's decision to leave the European Union. President Miloš Zeman apologized to the US ambassador to the Czech Republic, Andrew Shapiro, on Friday. The Czech head of state has accused Shapiro of not attending the Czech celebrations of National Day at the castle on the 28th of October in a speech welcoming the election of Donald Trump as the next US president. But photographs and statements from other participants at the main event quickly proved Zeman's accusations to be false. In a statement on Friday, Zeman said that he had received the information from the protocol section at the president's office. If this information was incorrect, the president of the republic, of course, apologizes to the ambassador. Relations between the US ambassador and President Zeman have been strained for some time. Former Czech-born U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright spoke in Prague on Friday on the impact of the election of Donald Trump as the next president of the U.S. Albright, who backed close friend Hillary Clinton, said the world had not ended but warned that things would evolve differently from what most people expected. In a conference at Charles University's philosophical faculty, she added that many Americans feared that they were not as rich as before and their jobs had moved to other countries. She said a gender factor was probably at play in the elections, with many white males feeling they had lost everything. She added that Europe should understand that US was both an Atlantic and a Pacific power. Several commemorative events took place across the Czech Republic on Friday to mark the International Veterans Day, including a ceremony at the National Memorial on Prague's Vítkov Hill and the decoration of 16 war veterans by Defence Minister Martin Stropnický. War veterans, in particular Czechoslovakia's RAF pilots, were also remembered on Prague's Náměstí Míru Square at an event organised by the local town hall, in cooperation with the Association of Veterans of the Czech Republic, the Czech Army Military History Institute and the Czechoslovak Legionnaires community. Veterans Day is celebrated all around the world to mark the signing of the armistice on the 11th of November 1918, which ended the First World War. The environment in the Czech Republic has not worsened in 2015 compared to the previous year, the Czech news agency reported on Friday, citing the annual report on the Czech environment. One of the persistent problems highlighted by the report is poor air quality, which has not improved sufficiently despite lower overall emissions. The report, put together by the Ministry of Environment, suggests that the quality of air was negatively affected in 2015 by extremely hot and dry weather. The report also suggests that public spending on protection of the environment continues to grow. The government is set to debate the report in November. I'm Ruth Franková, and that's the end of the news.
Hello, this is Radio Prague with me, Ian Willoughby. Today, the Czech Republic's women will be aiming to win tennis's Fed Cup for the fifth time in 6 years this weekend. St. Martin's wine, the Czech equivalent of Beaujolais Nouveau, has arrived. And later we hear about an exhibition of works by the great Czech photographer Josef Sudek in Canada. The Czech women's tennis team are looking to continue a winning run in the prestigious Fed Cup. Last year, the team clinched their fourth title in 5 years in front of home fans. This weekend, they're hoping to continue their streak by defeating the French in Strasbourg. Jan Wellinger has more.
The only time the Czech women's team failed to clinch the Fed Cup title in the last 5 years was in 2013, when the squad was absent in the final. Otherwise, the Czechs converted each time and will be hoping to continue their dominant run this Saturday and Sunday in Strasbourg, France. On the squad is former Czech number one and two-time Wimbledon champion Petra Kvitová, the current top Czech player Karolina Plíšková, Barbora Strýcová, and Grand Slam winning double specialist Lucia Hradecká. On paper, the squad can probably be considered the favorites, although the French team, coached by Amélie Maresmo, is no pushover. Caroline Garcia, Kristina Mladenovic, Alize Cornet, and Pauline Parmentier. The French players will have their home fans behind them, and not surprisingly, the build-up has been intense. In the run-up, Czech radio described how ads of the squads were visible on local trams and streets. The venue in Strasbourg, with a capacity of about 6,000 fans, should be packed, and that at least is the first impression that was described by Czech player Lucie Hradecká.
When we first saw it, the hall seemed small. I think it will sell out and that the atmosphere will be intense.
Fellow player Karolina Plíšková agrees, saying that the audience would be very vocal and visible.
The fans are seated quite close to the court, so I think they will make themselves heard. France has great fans, not just at Roland Garros, but at all tournaments. Things will probably get quite loud.
Petra Kvitová, seen by the French press as the clear leader on the team despite her recent fall to 11th spot in the WTA rankings, made clear she had had fun preparing for the final, commissioning a special pair of tennis shoes designed in the national colors, red, white, and blue, and featuring references to earlier wins. Back in 2011, when the women's team won their first title, the players had worn matching silver earrings of the Czech Lion. Is there a case of nerves ahead of this weekend? Petra Kvitová suggested that while the tournament would be intense, the final, the team could use its experience to its advantage. Here's what she had to say.
Having been there before, I think we are able to see things with a bit of distance. Of course, there is still pressure, but it is not as intimidating. I think they are there for the first time and don't know what to fully expect. They are playing at home, so that could be a little intimidating.
That report was by Jan Wellinger. November 11th, or St. Martin's Day, has always been associated with the first snow, reflected in the popular Czech saying, St. Martin arrives on a white horse. In recent years, the day has come to be known for something else altogether. Young wine from the year's harvest goes on sale in shops and at open-air markets around the country. Pavla Horáková has been finding out all about it.
Historically, November 11th was the day when winemakers in the Czech lands were first allowed to sell young wine. The recent tradition of St. Martin's wine relates to that, but also to an older culinary tradition, roast goose feast. Goose pairs nicely with young wine, and the combination is becoming more popular by the year. Prague-based sommelier Lucie Kohoutová, one of the people behind the Družstvo pop-up natural wine bar, explains.
It's true, it got joined with the trend of St. Martin's goose. That's pretty old, already from Middle Ages. But the hype about it really started only in 2005, when the Winemakers Fund of Czech Republic started to really actively promote it.
Similarly to the Beaujolais Nouveau tradition in France, the St. Martin's brand helps boost winemakers' cash flow right after the harvest. How do the two traditions compare?
The Beaujolais Nouveau is something older, definitely. It's from 1960s, 70s. And as for the quality, Beaujolais is mainly red. In Czech Republic, it's a lot about white, although you find a lot of rosés and red as well. Beaujolais is like 95% red. And this is due to geographical conditions, of course, because here it's kind of like quest with time sometimes, because of course we are much norther, and the harvest starts later than France. So especially in the years that are not that warm, like, I don't know, 2010, for example, the wine had to be made in like really extremely short period of time.
Not every wine makes it to the list that can be marketed as St. Martin's. Lucia Kohoutová again.
To have really have the brand on it, it has to be from chosen varietals that are as well white as red, and it also has to be approved by the winemakers fund. But to be honest, there are a lot of wines that are young, maybe often even more interesting, and the winemakers, they choose not to ask for the brand. So they do young wines and they sell it to people, but either because they don't want to be associated with the brand, or because they know that they wouldn't pass, they sell it like as young wine or under different names, but it is a young wine from the current harvest.
Over a glass on a chill November day, I asked Lucia if she was planning a traditional St. Martin's roast goose dinner this weekend.
We have nice tradition with my friends. It's been a couple of years already. We always gather in one of their apartments in a rather big group. Funny thing is that more and more of them were becoming vegetarian during the course of years. So now we're having half goose, half tofu. But it should happen this November as well, yes.
So let's drink to St. Martin's.
Cheers.
Cheers indeed. Now, Josef Sudek ranks as one of the greatest Czech photographers of all time. He's now the subject of a new exhibition at Canada's National Gallery in Ottawa. Jan Velinger hears all about the show now in this edition of The Arts.
A major retrospective of the works of the great 20th century Czech photographer Josef Sudek was launched recently by the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. It offers a unique opportunity for visitors there to get acquainted with Sudek's immense contribution to photography and his body of work, which includes famous series like From the Window of My Studio to Night Walks. Called The Intimate World of Josef Sudek, the show simply should not be missed. I spoke to the senior curator of photographs at the National Gallery of Canada, Anne Thomas, who was involved deeply in this project, and she began by explaining how it all came together.
We were given a very generous donation of Sudek's photographs in 2010, almost 1,700 prints. And so this was, you know, kind of motivation for us to do an exhibition, but also to show a Czech photographer. Well, not just a Czech photographer, but a photographer who was of such importance in the 20th century. The work's very beautiful, and we felt that our public needed to know the work better. So, yeah, that was, the motivation. It was twofold.
If we describe Sudek and his place in 20th century photography, because obviously he's very well known here, what other contemporaries would you rank him beside?
He's also very well known in Europe, and I would say in the United States as well. There have been many exhibitions there, but I think you can put him along with André Kertész, Paul Strand, a variety of major figures in 20th century photography, not because he shares an approach, but because of the contribution that he made and the kinds of photographs that he left. You know, yes, he could do romanticism, he could do modernism, he could do surrealism, but he was so true to his own story. You know, in The Intimacy, we see a struggle. So it's not just about romanticism. I think it's somebody who was, I think he was a great, if I was going to call him anything, not as stylistically, but as a personality, I think he was a realist in a way. He made from his world, which, as we know, was limited. You know, he had a small apartment, two rooms and a dark room and two windows and a lot of clutter around him. But he made something of all of that. He had managed to surmount brutal war injury and not just the physical part, but the mental apparatus that would have been in place after going through an experience like that. And so I see him as being quite realistic in the sense that he looks at the world that he occupies. He has a story to tell about his experience, and he responds to that. He doesn't look at some sublime ideal. That's why I'm just not that comfortable with the romanticism side of it. I think he's way more complex.
What did he actually photograph on most of the time, and what effect did that formally have on his work?
It was a large format camera, and when he first started photographing, he had no other option. That he didn't have like a 35 millimeter camera. And I think that's one of the great draws for me, is that this is work that was done with some effort, physical effort, because the cameras were larger than the little pocket cameras we have now. And there wasn't anything really random about what he photographed, in contrast to today, where people shoot, you know, a gazillion photographs a day without it really thinking. And so the equipment meant, but, you know, in the film that we're showing right now, Shaw's film, 1963 film, you see him with the camera, and he's got it slung over his back, and he manages to get it on his shoulder himself somehow. It's awkward, and carries his tripod. So, but even when, after 1926, when, you know, the Leica was on the market, a portable 35 millimeter camera, very sharp lenses, etc., he still opted for a larger format because he liked the amount of detail and the precision that he could get from a larger format camera. And, of course, he was doing contact prints for quite a large time. You know, he did that early on when he first came back from the war and took up photography, and, took up photography again. He had made some photographs in 1911, but he returned in a more serious way to it after World War I. By the 40s, he's only doing contact prints again. So, you know, I think that he wouldn't let any physical handicap come between him and what he aspired to do as an artist.
In a way, also, he became a larger-than-life character, I suppose, not unlike Bohumil Hrabal. He sort of became a well-known figure around Prague.
That's a very funny story about Dealer, who's told me this story about coming back from Prague with Sudex in the late 60s or early 70s. And the customs officer was going through his boxes, and the customs officer dropped the box, and Sudek fell on the ground, and he bent down the customs officer, and he went, Sudek, poet of Prague. So, you know, that's an indication of how well-known he was.
A retrospective like this one, there's many, many works there that you're showing. You've divided it along nine themes. So what are some of them, or what are some of the most dominant?
We started with early beginnings, and also we have a subsection of portraits of friends and artists. And then we have night walks, from my window, the spirit of place, and within that a subset would be Rottmeyer's Garden. But you're asking the most dominant. I would say that one of the largest groupings is From My Window. I think that's a sequence or a series of photographs that needs to be shown very fully because of the way in which he was able to, first of all, observe transformations, keep our interest very high in it because he's working within a very narrow field of perception, but it keeps changing, and he introduces new elements by composing the picture when he sees something of, you know, great interest happening on his window pane. So that's a very dominant one. And then also the life of the object is another very dominant group, and it has some subsections in it as well. So his labyrinth series, paper labyrinth, glass labyrinth.
I'd just like to ask if maybe we could characterize a little bit the kind of texture, the kind of light that we see in his photographs.
I think what's so wonderful about him is that he explores in depth not just reflected light, but also the absence of light. So his night walk, the group of photographs of night walks, is very powerful as his glass labyrinths, where he's introducing objects that are transparent, they're translucent, and he puts them into different arrangements, or reflective. So he puts them in different arrangements, not just to satisfy his technical skills or to show off his technical skills, but to make us become far more attuned to the complexity of light. He goes across like an incredible range, a spectrum of different ways of observing light. Sometimes it's just a shot of light that hits the surface of the table, and it's just a funny little abstract kind of white spot, you know. Another time it's pouring in shafts of light. He starts exploring this early on in his photographs, in his more pictorialist mode, where he's interested in how light highlights, almost in a spiritual way, the way that you get in Renaissance religious paintings, you know, that kind of sense that that light will illuminate and give substance to an object.
For example, you would have that in the photographs he took at St. Vitus's Cathedral in Prague.
Yeah. Yeah, and also in Valadovna. Yeah. And then later, when you get into the night walks where he, and for me, some of the most moving photographs in that series are several very dark, dense kind of layers of blackness that he took in the early years of World War II from his studio, which, you know, of course, is in that the first studio that he had, which is in the courtyard. He took these when there was a blackout, right? And it was absolutely forbidden at the cost of being persecuted severely to take photographs and to have lights on. But he noticed that some of the neighboring apartments had lights on. And so he photographed. Now, they would have been fairly protected from observation because they were in this courtyard. But they're wonderful photographs because there's just a spot of light coming through this dark, you know. So one hand, you think it symbolizes hope. And then on the other, it's also resistance, you know, resistance to authority, to the occupiers.
When this exhibition was being put together and you settled on the date itself is significant because October the 28th is Czech
National Day
or Independence Day, that's right. So yeah. Was that a decision that came early on?
No.
Or?
I'm terribly sorry to say, but no. We were very aware of the fact that the 2016 marks the 150th birthday of Sudek, but it was only that when the Czech ambassador brought this to my attention, he said, oh, you know, this is the National Day, and Czech and Slovak, right? So I said, oh, that's great. So, but in fact, we had to open the exhibition. It was open to the public on the 28th. So that was just a wonderful serendipity that it opened when it did.
That was Anne Thomas from the Canadian National Gallery in Ottawa, and she was speaking there to Jan Wellinger. If you've got any comments about today's program here on Radio Prague, please do share them with us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook or via Twitter. But that's all for now, folks. From me, Ian Willoughby, thank you very much indeed for listening to Radio Prague, and goodbye.